We are the ink to the page, Japan land the punch. Onomatopoeia, pal, we got the stuff. We know they got story, been new, they got hot. Complex narratives and black carriers, tell me where they see us. Where I see us, where I see us, they wanna be us. But tell me where they read us, no, they wanna be us. Out the damn cage like a nigga from Georgia. Insane and out the brain and lacking in origin. Act flashbacks and shots to the system. Downloading new issues and sitting for a listen. Where I see us, where I see us, they wanna be us. But tell me where they read us, no, they wanna be us.
They wanna be us, they wanna be us. Where I see us,
where all the black people at, man?
All right. Well, welcome back to another episode of Where I See Me, the podcast where we look at comics and media with lots of questions in mind, mainly where the hell are all the black and brown people? And so I'm Jamie.
And I am Marcellus.
And so today on the podcast, it is a crossover episode. We have Jocelyn and Jessica of Chicas Who Read podcast. So let's welcome them to the show.
Hello.
This has been like months of like coordinating in the making.
Sorry for being over here.
It's okay. You're here. You're here now. And you know what? It worked out really great because the film we're talking about today, I think I'm really curious to hear what y'all are going to have to say about it. But first, can you tell like our listeners a little bit about Chicas Who Read and y'all's podcast or how y'all met?
Oh my God. So it's like a long story, but
That's fine.
Jocelyn and I met working for a company I will not name because I will not give them free publicity. but it was for a cosmetics company, and that's where we became friends, and we both really have like really amazing conversations about just anything, and we both like to read and watch movies, so I don't really remember exactly how we got the idea to start a podcast together.
Well, it originally was we wanted to start a book club because we both wanted to read more actively. And there were like, we started podcasts that'll hold us accountable, which still did not.
No! Yeah, we haven't posted since like 1959. So.
Girl, stop.
So, yeah. But it's been fun. We're planning on getting back to it. It's just, you know, life gets in the way.
It does.
Yeah, take it at your own pace when it's good to you.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's how it started out, and Jocelyn and I are like best friends, so it's fun. It's a good time.
Got that exclusive origin story.
You heard it here first. It's minted.
I've been listening to y'all's podcast since it came out, and I really enjoy it. Aww. Especially there was one, it was an episode, it was like y'all's Halloween episode, and y'all watched some movie where they had babies in jars of rum or something, and I'm like, what? You know what I'm talking about?
I remember the movie, but I don't remember the name. I think
you talking about Boss Baby? Yeah.
They had, well, when they went down there, in the little scene where they're like, they replay when they push the boy in the water or something.
Oh, okay, yeah. I was like, babies in jars. But yeah, that was The Devil's Backbone by Guillermo del Toro.
Okay, because I've never seen the movie, and even after listening to y'all talk about it, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to watch it. I'll just listen to Jocelyn and Jessica talk about it.
You too scared, Jamie?
I mean, they said it wasn't scary, but like.
You don't like some jar babies?
I don't think I want to see a jar baby. Well, I've probably already seen a baby in a jar.
Where you seen a baby in a jar?
Some movie that's like set in a hospital somewhere.
To say like a physical place.
Oh no, not in real life.
That's good.
American Horror Story.
I think so.
They have babies in a jar somewhere, some season. I think the first season.
Oh, I think I may have seen like clips from the first season. I don't think I've actually watched. I only watched season three because that was the coven season. And then I tried to watch season four, which was the one with the clown.
I think. Ooh, circus.
And the circus one. I couldn't do it. Even though like Patti LaBelle was in it and she was, and Angela Bassett, but I'm like, I can't do it. They was killing people on the first episode, and I'm like, I can't do this.
Yeah, I liked Circus. I didn't watch the Coven one. I think that one was the only one that I didn't watch. And then the most recent one, because I fell off. But I Jar Babies in the first season, I think. Could have been Jar Babies, or could have just been like regular, you know, full-size adults in jars, like adult parts in jars.
Ooh. Ooh.
Anyway.
Oh my god.
we didn't watch anything with Jar Babies for today.
Yeah.
But we did get to enjoy a wonderful documentary by the name of Stateless. Or, well, that's the English name for the film, I do believe. Jamie, do you remember the other title for the film?
I think it's Apatrida, but I might be saying it wrong because there's an accent mark on one of the A's and I don't know how to do that. So, but Apatrida, oh Lord Jesus, help me. But you're, yes, yeah, so we watched Stateless, which was being aired through Third Horizon Film Festival, which is based out of Miami, Florida.
Shout out to them.
At the time of this airing, the festival will be over. So, but definitely check out Third Horizon Film Festival. They had a lot of great films. I watched more than just a documentary that we all agreed to watch. I don't know about the rest of you. Did y'all watch any other films so far? Or have y'all watched any other films so far from the film festival?
No, I haven't gotten a chance to.
No, but we're planning, well, depending on like what time we're done recording, we're planning on watching Bulado.
Me too. Yes.
So good.
Yes. I'm excited about that one. Anytime there's like a little girl and like some kind of like coming of age, I'm like, yeah, I'm in it.
And then you add the layer of like spookiness.
Scary movie.
Seems scary. It seems like more like wholesome, you know, like spiritually wholesome.
I think so too. That's why I'm looking forward to it. But what we're gonna be talking about on the show today, we're gonna be talking about Stateless, which is directed by Michelle Stevenson, who is of Panamanian and Haitian descent. And typically makes films that revolve around provocative stories that speak to personal and systemic liberation. This documentary, I mean, I knew, so from the clips that I saw, I knew we were going to be following Rosa Edis the majority of the time. I'm going to let y'all start because I'm so curious to hear, because we all saw each other like over the weekend. We kind of like kept it to ourselves.
I love
So, I'm really curious about y'all's thoughts on the film, like overall. Like what was the impression you were left with at the end of the film?
Well, honestly, it was kind of frightening in that we're kind of seeing this play out, this idea, well, what was happening in the documentary with Haitians and Dominicans was the Dominican Republic, well, the government was trying to push, you know, people of not only just Haitians, but like Haitian descent, people have generations, And, you know, America always sees what's going on in the rest of the world. And they also had, you know, a foot in what happened in you know, the whole island of Hispaniola and what is happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
There. But just the idea of us getting displaced, you know, just from being first generation Mexican, speaking personally, to imagine a law being enacted where I was told that I was no longer an American citizen, and then being pushed out of the country that I've only ever known, and then being pushed to Mexico, where I can semi get around with speaking the language, but don't know the country at all.
Right.
Or the customs. And that's why I thought it was frightening. But just to see that these people are in that case itself, and just seeing Rosa Iris really just being moved by these people's stories and really compelled to help them was really moving. So that's what I got initially from the documentary.
Yeah.
I was like, really, I wasn't surprised, because I know that anti-blackness runs so deep in Latin America. We've been so brainwashed by colonialism. And even though I was not surprised, I was still upset by the situation, you know? There's so many other, and I wanna reserve my comments for when we get like into the conversation of the film. But piggybacking off of what Jocelyn said, it's like the issue at hand is that they're basically trying to wipe out all of the Haitians in the Dominican Republic, where it's a country that like 80% of the people are African descendants. So it's like, what, you know, you have this hatred towards Haitians and this bias, right? But what about these other countries that invaded you, and of those countries, you still accept them there? So what really is the reason why you want Haitians out? And it's because of blackness, basically anti-blackness.
Yeah, I think, oh, go ahead, Marcellus.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, I feel like my stomach was gurgling throughout the film. Kind of just in that same realm of thinking about the sort of the anti-blackness that sort of permeates, not even just through like within the sort of the government related issues, like the bureaucracy, the paperwork and everything that we get to kind of see in the news. We see the news reports that are cutting in and out, showing like the presidents and other sort of representative figures that we get peeks at. But I don't know, it felt kind of like I had an idea of what to expect on some level of how poisonous some of the words would be at the beginning of the film. You know, just thinking about like Jessica said, the sort of erasing of Haitians out of DR, but then to kind of see it, I think, person to person. And I won't, you know, I'm sure we'll get into what that actually looks like as we talk more about it. But just like seeing all this camera footage of how many layers of security and sort of like people are actively assisting in that was made me feel pretty gross to see that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I left the film feeling angry, but also just kind of like flabbergasted by some of like the more like blatant anti-blackness in the film, not the film itself, but you know, like the documentation of it happening, And we'll talk about the scene where Theophile goes to, I think, the consulate to try and get like his.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That scene, oh my gosh. I wanted to fight that man. like, it was so horrible. Going into the documentary, I knew that this was an issue. Because I remember hearing in another podcast a couple of years ago about how there was this young boy who the MLB, I think, was trying to draft him. And he had no papers because of these laws. He was of Haitian descent, but he was born in the Dominican Republic. And because of the laws, he had no, like, no official records or birth certificates, even though he may have had those things. They didn't recognize him. And I believe he was like, he grew up in one of the like campos, one of the like sugarcane cutting communities. And he was just kind of stuck. And I remember hearing that and just being like, that is, I don't know, like it's a complete erasure of an entire group of people who are still there, who are like physically, you can go and see them or like you see them walking around and then, but the government doesn't recognize them. Or wasn't is trying to purposely erase them. It was just really, I didn't know how bad it was, but the film really kind of like opened my eyes to it. Cause I knew that there was always been like bad blood between Haitians and Dominicans, which is so fascinating because they're on the same island. It's just the French had one side, the Spanish had the other, right?
Right.
But the Africans they were bringing were the same Africans. They just ended up on different, you know, ends of the island. But whatever, you know, Haiti got its independence in 1804, and the world never really forgave them for that. At least the white world never forgave them for that. And I think some of that, I don't know, may have transferred into the Dominican Republic in some ways. But I'm not 100% sure, but I do know that like this is like centuries old stuff that has not been properly dealt with at all.
Yeah, and how that's another thing too. Like it's so deeply ingrained in people's consciousness. It's like how do you combat this? I think that like. Rosa Iris, I saw in the end, you know, it said that she, I don't know if this is a spoiler, but got asylum in the U.S. after being threatened so much. And like her child was stalked after school. And she was seeing all of this violence as an activist and mm-hmm. attorney. And she was the person trying to combat that. And where do you start? You know, I think it takes like people having a reckoning with their internalized anti-blackness and like really taking into account the history of violence in that country mm-hmm. and all of Latin America, really, but and the US. Shit, this whole hemisphere. But that takes like accountability, you know? Hold yourself accountable for the heinous shit that you actively participated in from being brainwashed. And people can't handle that truth. Some people don't even want to see that truth or even think about it. So it's like, it's a really tough situation.
At the end of the after the film, did either of you get a chance to peek at the Q&A?
No, we missed it.
No, I missed it too.
I caught part of it. I think like the second half of it, and someone, a man, asked a question, and it was a hard question to answer because he was more or less trying to say, you know, why is this film not balanced? But he did it, and he presented the question after he's talking about, you know, I grew up in you know, Dominican Republic as well, And I was never really raised with the idea of, you know, am I black, am I white, am I what's going on? And then I came to the U.S. I came to, I think he had said New York. And it was kind of like he was negating Rosa's experience and being like, I didn't see this, you know, violence and ugliness you're talking about. Like, that's not the DR I know. So how am I, you know? It was like it's like you were saying, how do you reckon with that? How do you get accountability when even people who may have even been in, you know, could have been in the same situation but weren't, they don't recognize it in there. He said, that's not the DR I see when I go back. I don't know. And they tore his head off. the director was much kinder, but there was another, like a filmmaker or someone who was also there to represent and kind of speak on the issues, and she absolutely bit his head off. It was good. It was fun to see. But
as they should. Well, I did a little bit of research as to, because yeah, I was curious as to when these racial tensions got so high, and I like that Jamie said, like, the white world never forgave Haiti.
Yeah.
But so the U.S. occupied the island of Hispaniola, which both include Haiti, and the DR from like 1915 to like the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And after they left, they put Rafael Trujillo as the president. I say that with quotations because he was more of a dictator. And that's kind of where you see like the president that precedent that was set for today's racial tensions, with he enacted basically the Parsley massacre, which killed so many Haitians and a lot of people of Haitian descent. Because it's called the Parsley massacre because you say parsley, I guess there you roll an R whenever you say parsley in Spanish, and so Haitians couldn't get the R right, and so that was a dead giveaway that they were Haitian or of Haitian.
Oh no.
Yeah, and so you just kind of, and that was only, he was assassinated in 1960. So literally, you know, not that long ago, like people that were part of the Parsley massacre or were able to flee are still able to tell their stories today. So it wasn't even that long ago. So you see racial tensions like really in the film. And there was this one line by that conservative, you know,
woman. Oh, Gladys.
Name besides Raposa.
I remember her last name because it was Feliz, and that's happy in Spanish. And I'm like, she's not Feliz. I guess you're naive. She's the Karen of the Dominican Republic.
She really is. When she was talking about like my grandfather's grandfather was one of the first presidents of the Dominican Republic. I was like, oh, I know where this is going. Because that's when we first meet her, right? She was trying to, I don't know what her relationship was to the director, because it seemed like she was trying to show the director like certain sites and things, or like she wanted to go to the border and she was like, oh, we can't go across. And then like the next couple of scenes, it's like Edith goes across. It's like, and it's no problem. But what were we gonna say about Gladys?
It rubbed away when she was all like, the man, whenever they were talking to people with Haitian descent, and they were our grandparents or our parents came here because they were sugarcane workers, and she denied that, and she was like, oh, all those people died a long time ago.
Yeah. She said that the one man, she was like, he's too young to have done that work. Yeah. She's like, it's hard work. He would have been dead already.
She's all of a sudden a historian. And a.
She's an expert.
Yeah, she's a sugarcane expert. She worked the fields herself. She knows.
Which you were wrong, because I did research and I was like, I'm sure Haitian people still work there. And they do.
God.
I mean, meanwhile, she couldn't even find where they lived. So, you know, she was going on all these wrong turns and asking people. And also, I love people. I love that there were people who were like, no one lives over here like that. No, that's not here. Because I kind of got the sense that maybe it was like a protective thing. Like, what do you want with them? Like, why are you trying to find them?
True.
I loved that scene. I found it hilarious. Have these like angry, disgusting, decrepit white Tinos in a car trying to find like a community of Haitians to go judge and criticize, and every turn it's like, oh no, we're not gonna help you. Like, so other guy helped them because he was in need. He's like, all right, like, give me money and I'll take you, you know? And I don't blame him for that. Get your money. But it just shows how far removed they are from this community and from the truth of history. And I thought that part in the film was so beautifully executed in that way, because you could tell just how clueless they were in that moment. You could tell that their convictions are based on a bias.
Oh, absolutely.
That, I mean, yeah. I guess to kind of like get us into the film, because we're already like jumping in. But it starts with what Rosa is trying to help this young man who he was trying to go to school, but they wouldn't let him into the school because I think his papers weren't right. And she goes with him because the lady just kind of was really dismissive of him and was saying like, oh, well, you speak Spanish funny. You're not, like, the whole like policing of the Spanish language thing was like right off the bat. Mm-hmm. We were getting that. She was like, oh, well, you say, you know, and his last name also sounded French too. So it was just kind of like, oh, like, as soon as they hear that, they're not going to help you. Like, they were not. But Rosa was there to kind of, like, help, like, get him. I don't remember if he got his papers or his paperwork or not.
We don't see, because I remember there was the woman sort of point blank is like, you know, you have all these things to defend him. I got to defend myself. I don't think he gets them, or at least we don't see him get the papers.
Right. I think it was just kind of like an introduction to Rosa, so we could get a sense of who this person was, mm-hmm. or who she is, and the type of work that she does. But we see this, and then also the entire documentary is framed around this narrative about a little girl who was fleeing during the Parsley massacre, and was like fleeing into the woods, and her story is kind of like split up throughout and uses these kind of transitions between different events of the documentary. But we start off with Rosa, and then for the most part, I really thought it was just gonna be a film about Rosa the entire, and I would have been happy with it, but the director, I think, was very fair in like trying to have a concern so we could get a sense of what the conservatives were thinking. And so she introduces Gladys, and then eventually we also get
the Pips.
Gladys, boy.
I'm sorry.
You did not. That do not do Gladys Knight. My God. But eventually we do get Rose. You know, I don't know. Like, it's just kind of following her day in the life, and she eventually goes to Haiti. Which she in the documentary she was like she had never been to Haiti before. She is also someone who is of Dominican and Haitian descent. So one of her parents was Haitian, which seems to be it seems to be so common that, you know, you have some, like, maybe your dad was Haitian and your mom is Dominican, or vice versa. Like, one parent was Haitian. It's the same island, and their border is so fluid. You can go back and forth with ease. You just cross a river. And apparently there's like 85 different like checkpoints along this river that you can go across with relatively no problem from what it seemed, even though Gladys was trying to make it seem like it was a problem. She was like, see, we can't go. And I'm like,
as someone's like going across.
I was like, okay, girl.
It's too deep.
Border are like, what are you talking about? Yes, you can. Just go.
She just like intentionally didn't bring her passport or something. Like, that's probably what it was. Like, she just didn't.
That's so bad.
Oh, Gladys. But we get to see Rosa's life. And she eventually goes to Haiti and she meets up with her cousin, Theophilio, and who has two children who are living in DR. And he's having to stay in Haiti because of this whole law that's being passed. I mean, did they ever say what the name of the law was?
I think it was... I might be wrong, but it might be Resolution 12, or like the 12th resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Might be wrong. Don't quote me on that.
Well, it's okay.
I've just quoted you. It's going on CNN.
No.
But it was so backwards. The idea that it was like retroactive
to 1929.
Yeah. Yes.
That should wild. Wild, because I'm like, what? Jocelyn, what year was the Parsley Massacre? Do you remember?
I wrote it down. Give me 1 second. 1937.
That's real close.
Yeah,
that's real close. Yeah. Oh, okay. I had to do the math again in my head because time. So 1929 is. They denied if you are of Haitian descent and you're born in DR between 1929 to present, you have no citizenship, which is insane. That's
100 years.
It is almost 100 years. And I'm trying to think what year did, let me look back at this page. They made, I think this documentary, oh, she made this in 2020. Okay.
Yeah, 20.
The ruling was in 2013.
Yes.
This happened in the documentary was in 2020.
It's still just, I don't like it. So I'm going to read the synopsis of the film just because we've been talking about it, but I didn't know if we really said what it was about. So the film is called Stateless. In 2013, the Dominican Republic Supreme Court stripped the citizenship of anyone with Haitian parents retroactive to 1929. The ruling rendered more than 200,000 people stateless without nationality, identity, or a homeland. Stateless traces the complex tributaries of history and present-day politics as state-sanctioned racism seeps into mundane offices, living room meetings, and street protests. Anyone defending marginalized groups face threats of violence in this dangerous climate. A young attorney named Rosa Edis mounts a grassroots campaign challenging electoral corruption and advocating for social justice. As Rosa balances her congressional run with her dedication to her family community, the full scope of her fight is revealed. So that's pretty much, I mean, yeah, the film is really centered around Rosa, but we do get other hints, like characters like Gladys and her cousin Theophilio.
Which feels good. It feels appropriate because it would be, I think, a disservice to have a vacuum that's just the, because she's charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it wouldn't give us the full reality of all the people who exist and are either just trying to prove they should be considered real on paper, and the people who adamantly disagree.
Yeah. Were there any scenes from the documentary that stuck out to you guys or left an impression?
So many.
All of them.
So here's the thing. This documentary is in the context is very powerful
Mm-hmm. Also, the way it is filmed is beautiful. And the way it's edited is beautiful. And that's what that's something that I really liked, that in between, so you have three different roles or three different films kind of integrated into one. You have this background that give you all these different reference points. You have this background of this little girl who's trying to escape during the Parsley massacre, and that is more of like a poetic, mm-hmm. quote unquote poetic, because that's very tragic, but it's very beautiful. Like, you have these children hiding in the water, and the landscape is very dreamlike, and it made me feel like it was timed, how it was like in the past. Mm-hmm. And then you the documentary part of it, where you're seeing Rosa Iris work with different Haitian descendants to combat this law. And then you also have these other documentary or documented instances of Trujillo spewing such ridiculous defensive rhetoric. So one of the things that I remember him saying that made me laugh, he was like, why, you know, can Republic racist country racist if we have any Black people here? And it made me think of, like, you know how white people here are like, I'm not racist, my friend is Black. And that's what that made me think of. And I thought it was hilarious, but also, again, very revealing. And so these three different reference points really make this film so beautiful and so revealing in that way. I loved it.
Yeah, for me, a scene that stuck out the most is just her in the end after they're saying the campaign results, and she's just sitting on her couch and she says out loud, that's not even, they say how many votes she got, and it's like 27 or something like that. And she's like, that's not even my family right there. Mm. So know how rigged it is.
Yeah. I remember even like the scenes where the president is like campaigning and there were people out in the rain, like to see him. And she was like, there were people saying, oh, well, he paid them to like come out and support him. And they asked him like, oh, did you pay people to come out? I love that their media would be just like, did you pay people to come out and like cheer you on as you run for a re-election or election? And he was like, no, they would never. No one would stand in the rain to be paid. And I'm like, yes, they would.
I mean, I'd stand in the rain.
I'd stand in the rain if you're going to pay me a decent like wage to like wave a flag. Yeah.
I'd do that for a Subway sandwich.
Not Subway.
Well, I don't want Jimmy John's.
Oh, definitely not. I hate Jimmy John's.
Can't yeah, I would. Mm-mm.
I used to eat it all the time when I was in Florida, and it was...
Ooh.
I know. Exactly. Exactly. All of that. But I agree with you, Jessica, about like the balance between all these different narratives. It really just makes the documentary really tight, and the narrative really tight, and you really get kind of a full picture of what's happening in this country. Mm-hmm.
I feel like for me, one of the scenes that stuck with me for a while was when she was coming home to like her family and friends, and just seeing all these people that she helped in the past, mm-hmm. describing how long it had taken to get their papers fully set, and seeing that one young man who she was saying, you were so skinny, and she like pulled up her pinky dress. But just seeing like he was she had seen that he got his papers finally off of like Facebook or something, like a Facebook post, and he was just big cheesing, big, like all happy, and he said it'd been 8 years. And sort of just, I think seeing her thought process and kind of like her heart on her sleeve as they were describing things, I don't know, I feel like it was a really clear window into how long she's been doing a lot of this work and just how close she gets to everyone around her in her community. Especially just seeing how mad she got very quickly. Seeing one of her other friends, you know, getting disrespected on the job.
Yeah, and he was like security. He works in, no, he was a cop.
He was a police. He was a police officer. I think they had said. I think they called him Haitian as an insult. And she, I think she started crying, even tears in her eyes, like angry tears, of course, but. And then kind of launching into, you know, her I want to say the word manifesto, but honestly, it's just like the truth that she carries on her, you know, in her mind, in her heart. But just seeing how it's kind of the expectation of being able to get your papers is so low that if you get it, it's like active, just go all out, just act a fool, be happy. It's kind of like, it makes me think of the same sort of feeling of seeing someone move out of a neighborhood that people get stuck in. Mm-hmm. Like the idea of you did it, so like make the most of this, like we're behind you, we're happy for you. And it makes her tears feel, I think, even more bittersweet. Because even after you get your papers, there's still you have the general public.
Yeah, and there's still way more people to help. That's the one thing. I would want to know how many other lawyers are doing this work as well, because it's such a big issue that, like, in the film, I'm just thinking about this as you were talking, Marcellus, like, it makes it feel so... I mean, it's a really heavy job that she has taken on to help all these people to get their citizenship. It makes me wonder what other people are doing this work as well, because it can't, I mean, obviously it can't just be her alone.
Oh, no, no, no. I think I don't have an answer per se, but I do know, at least at the end, during the Q&A, they mentioned certain profits or opening donations for trying to help 60 people who were in this legal sort of battle. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely got to be organizations, if not, because seeing how much danger she was in as an individual, I'm sure there has to be at least teams of people trying to keep one another safe as they do this work.
Yeah, like when she was talking about, like, someone had like called her, but did someone like call her mom and said, you need to get your daughter to stop talking before she ends up like in the forest with ants in her mouth or something like that. They said it's really graphic things that they were saying to her. And even like, just, I think you had mentioned like her son was being stalked. They knew what clothes he was wearing. They knew what time he got out of school. And just like, and I think,
baby,
he's just a little baby, and like he wanted to go to work with his mom, I think, one day. Mm-hmm. I think that's when we first meet them, in very early on in the film. He's like, please, 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 please let me go with you, and she's like, you can't go with me today. But it's, I'm trying to think, the things that stood out to me particularly, like thinking about like the children, how that affects them, was when Teofilio came over from Haiti to DR to go to the consulate, before he went to the consulate, he went to see his kids. And they were so happy to see him. And there's like, the shot is very kind of like, it's a kind of a voyeuristic shot, but it was like trying to give them space, mm-hmm. to like privacy. And he asked his son, he was like, you failed your class. Why did you fail your class? And the little boy was like, the teacher doesn't like me. And they didn't really go into it because it's like, we know why the teacher don't like him, right? Like, his father is Haitian. That's why the teacher does not like him. And it just made me sad because it's like, how is it also affecting like children in school, right? If they have teachers who are discriminating against them, who think that they can't learn anything because they're Haitian. It made me very sad for him.
Yeah, that was really heart-wrenching to watch because it's like these families are just getting displaced. And like I said earlier, like, how do you go to a whole nother country where you have no roots and you have no family there and you just have to make it work? And in this case, he had to leave his children behind.
Mm-hmm.
Children clearly need him. Like, everybody needs a father, and he actively wants to be there for them. And he's fighting too by like trying to get his papers, and just seeing him go through the process and him actually having actual paperwork and them denying that paperwork and telling him that it's false.
Yes. When they were like, Sonia's not your mother.
Hmm.
Like, excuse me?
I believe I know my mother.
That was so wild to me. Like, you know, the guy, he was just like, you know, he was like, you come in here with all this stuff and you, there's no need for you to make this argument. You already know what it is. And it's like, no, it's like unspoken, that no one, like, it's blatant, but it's like also, I don't, not subtle, because that was very aggressive when he was within that office.
It was casual how he did it.
Thank you. That's the word. It was very casual. Very, very casual.
He already had his mind made up, you know, in this position. Like, he's going to be a gatekeeper.
And
that's exactly what he did. He didn't care. Like, how are you going to act like administrative errors aren't a thing? You know, like, how? It's just ridiculous.
I was telling Marcellus, like my ex-boyfriend is Dominican, and like on his birth certificate, there's like, they put the birth date wrong on it, but they just kind of like, you know, went with it, right? And I'm like, if he's so casual and not wanting to do his job, this guy in the consulate, then I can absolutely believe that people made mistakes on people's birth certificates all the time. And also, if you were born in a rural community where there's no hospitals, right? Like, when do you go and get your birth certificate? Like, if a kid is born in like November, December of like, say, 1935, and then maybe they go in January, February of 1936 and go get the birth certificate, then it's going to have that year, right? Like, these things, they happen, right? Like, it happens. And for him to kind of be like, oblivious, or not even oblivious, he knows that they happen. The administrator knows that these things happen. He just didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
He
weaponized these things to not help Delfilio.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's sad because when I was watching that scene of him and his children, I was thinking about fatherhood and how these children really need their father in their life. Like, he clearly loves them and wishes he could be there for them, but he also feels, well, one, he can't because he doesn't have papers, but also, like, he feels wronged by betrayed by the Dominican Republic, and he doesn't want to be there or to have children there. And it just, there's so many parallels in how the racism and these laws and how it manifests itself in the family, how those consequences manifest themselves in the family, also manifest themselves in the systemic racism here. Like, it made me
think
about Black fatherhood and how a lot of Black fathers are ripped away from their, Black and brown fathers are ripped away from their children for minor drug charges, and those children grow up without their fathers. And in the same way, this is happening to God knows how many in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah. I and you know and Theophilio, I would feel betrayed. Like he has been betrayed by his nation, right? Like he has been betrayed and wanting to get his kids out of there and move them to Haiti with him so that he at least can like be with them and they will be somewhere where, I mean, I don't know. I've never heard anything about like Haitians discriminating against people from DR. I've always heard it the other way around, but like maybe they'd be in a better place. They're with their father in a place where they're not likely to be discriminated against because the teacher knows that they're Haitian or they're of Haitian descent. His story made me the saddest because there was no resolution and he only got to see his kids once. Like he tried to call and see them again, but I don't know I can't remember what happened where he couldn't, they were like, he wanted to like, I think pick them up from school or something. And he was asking if it was okay, if he could do it. And something happened where it was just like, it wasn't going to happen. I don't know, but it made me really sad. Like his story made me so sad because he, like you said, like here you have a father who actively wants to be in his children's life, but can't because of the state, because of the government. It's just really unfortunate that particular situation.
Mm-hmm. And it makes me think too of like just how disgusting and the reach these consequences have on these communities that are affected. Like I was thinking while watching the film, like this is pretty much trying to get rid of first, like a whole generation, like first generation Dominican Republican or Dominican Republicans. Wow.
Dominican. You talking about Gladys?
Yeah, she's Dominican Republican. you know, wipe out a whole first generation of Dominicans. And I remembered like hearing Gladys talking about, oh, well, Haitians are the ones who come into this country and rape people.
Yes.
Cause all this crime. And you have, so it's like, it goes much deeper than that, idiot. Like, have these people whose papers are taken away from them, they're stateless, they don't have as much access to resources and are actively being put into poverty and really strenuous situations that cause that, like we all know poverty increases crime, and mm-hmm. there could be some correlation. Could not, I didn't look into those statistics, but I don't think you have to know the social implications of oppressing a whole group of people to where they have no way out. Like I was thinking about the consequences of not having like even for myself, like speaking on a personal note, I'm first generation, and if I didn't have any legal status in this country, I wouldn't have the opportunity to be able to bring in more income into my family and be able to come out of the financial situations that my family has been in because they're not from here. You know what I mean? So it's mm-hmm. like, it's so parasitic, pretty much. Like there's so many levels to it that the state knows what it's doing by putting these people in a really hard spot and keeping them there.
Yeah. And I think another point that I think, I don't remember if it got brought up in the documentary, is that so people who are of Haitian descent who were born in the Dominican Republic, they also cannot get Haitian citizenship. Mm-hmm. So that is, you know, that's the other side of it too. Like you're born in this nation, the Dominican Republic, you should have citizenship there. maybe if you have, I don't know how, you know, some countries, like if your mother, like if you're one of your parents is from this country, you get automatic citizenship. You just gotta like fill out a form or something.
Mm-hmm.
Some countries are like that. Some are not. I don't really know if Haiti is like that or not, but these people are they're literally in limbo because neither government system will help them. Right. And on the instance with Haiti, like I get it because it's like y'all were born there. Like DR needs to step up and like take care of its citizens, regardless of what their ethnic heritage may be. But at the same time, like, I don't know, like, I feel like Haiti should also do something as well. And maybe they are. And we didn't really see that particular side of it in the film. But I think it was mentioned that like they can't get citizenship in either place. So they are literally just like, as the title says, stateless.
Yeah, like they kept talking. Gladys kept talking about them getting deported, and these of like freaking crazy people were talking about getting them deported. Deport where?
Yeah.
That really bothered me that they kept talking about this as an immigration issue.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it was so easy to pass through that river. And Haitians that were originally there were forced to work in these sugarcane fields. Mm-hmm. It's now willingly. But then it became a cycle of like, oh, we have the DR has a better economy. We're going to work over there and stay over there. And with that law to retroactively put it for 29, like that's not even just one generation, that's multiple generations being displaced, like people who have created roots there, like
dead generations.
Mm-hmm.
How are you gonna remove papers from the grave?
Get deported while you're already buried.
Like what?
Oh my gosh. So the scene with Gladys and her homegirls in like their living room, like spewing all of their like anti-Haitian rhetoric was, it sounded so much like white Americans who were very pro-Trump. Like the things were identical. Like the things they were saying, like the whole like rapists and murders and all that stuff. Like that is everyone's go-to.
Yeah.
Whenever we were gonna say,
she said building a wall.
Yes, a wall, a wall. I'm like, are you serious? A wall, a wall.
And did you catch that part where it was like, I didn't have the time to look into this, but I was like, of course, when they were talking about how Israel had offered build a wall,
mm-hmm.
and it can. Mm-hmm. They were going to fund it. It's like, of course, this genocidal state is going to try to inhibit Haitians from coming into the Dominican Republic. Like, of course, they're interested.
With U.S. funding, no doubt.
Of course.
It circles all the way back around. Someone once told me, or no, I heard it in a podcast, that the United States, I don't know if we still do this, but we used to police the Haitian and Dominican border because our government determined that they weren't doing it right. So
how do you go over someone's house and just decide, I don't think you use this correctly. Let me show you.
I heard it in another podcast. I can't think of the name of the podcast, but the person in it is from the Dominican Republic. And she's I don't know if she calls herself an activist or not. Like she's very outspoken online about issues in DR, anti-blackness in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
But she was like, yeah, the US, they were policing our border and telling us, because she was like, it's a fluid border. Like people just kind of go and come as they please. I mean, any border that has like 85 checkpoints or 85 different entry points, mm-hmm. I mean, that's, and that island's not that big.
Yeah, where else would you go?
But yes, I did catch that part about Israel, because I'm like, that seems like some U.S. by way of Israel, like backing of a border. And it's, yeah, it's, wow. When she said it's a Haitian invasion, I was like, girl, come on now. Come on now.
Like,
like an invasion? Really?
Like a sense.
So the person that I mentioned before, the activist, Bad Dominicana, Zahira Kelly, she, every now and then she'll like say things, because she was in New York and she moved back to DR. I think she actually lives in, she advertised it, but I won't say where she lives. But it was in one of the places that was in the documentary. And she was talking about like how there's certain families who are the whiter families in DR. And I say whiter because the way whiteness functions there to me is interesting, because none of them people were white to me, but I know that they're white in their country.
But they are white.
Huh?
They are white.
Because they think white?
No, because they are white.
Wait, what?
Yes. Okay, hold on. Are we talking about Gladys and her white Tino friends?
Yes.
They are white.
But they don't look white to me.
They don't look white because all of Latin America has been colonized and we are mixed with African and indigenous and white roots, but they are white.
Okay.
They're
white. I'm like, y'all look kind of beige to me.
Yeah, they can look beige, but their race is white. Their ethnicity is Latino. And that's why I'm like, they're white Tinos, they're Karen. And that's why it's so easy for them to be this way.
Yeah. They were something else. And it makes me, one of the things I was about to mention was that Bad Dominicana was saying that on the island, the whiter families kind of like self-segregated themselves to a certain section of the island. And so that's, I think, where a lot of all of these like political candidates, wealthy people, they come out of there. So they have no real, like, I guess, understanding of how the rest of the island functions or what it looks like or what it like for her to show up at the border and be like, you can't cross. Right.
Like never been there.
That's like the first time she tried to cross.
I think so.
Because like the idea that the party, sort of like the political identity being national, like their nationalistic supporters, when it should be more like a neighborhood. Like it feels like a PTA has gone large.
It does. That nationalist part, their protests, I'm like, that's very Trump-esque. Very, very Trump-esque.
Very Trumpian.
But you know what? Their people have been saying that Trump is not, he's not an isolated incident, and that, and it's not even that he necessarily influenced these other places, that this kind of nationalism and conservatism has been growing for decades in multiple countries because of how people are moving in the world. Like people there, you have lots of people seeking asylum. You have people who are fleeing their countries for various reasons. And you have these really nationalist campaigns of people who are, now mind you, I feel like it's happening a lot in the European countries and probably like all of our hemisphere, most likely. I don't know so much about Africa, although there is an influx of, that's a whole nother episode of the podcast. Because that's a whole nother thing. But that his, you know, he wasn't like, we were giving him more credit than he deserved. Yeah. Because all of these sentiments were already in place. It's just like, oh, America agrees with us. We can be louder now.
Yeah. You can tell I'm glad you brought up that you were reminded by Trump supporters with the Karens all gathered in the living room, because that's like the way whiteness performs.
Mm-hmm.
we can see it now in this documentary. It just makes it, the parallels are a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. It makes me very curious about the state of our world. where is all of this going? Because it's just, I mean, not to go into a depressing tangent, but it does make me really wonder, like, because all of this is not sustainable. Like, there are people actively committing genocide. There are nations actively committing genocide, but it's like, none of this is sustainable. Like, what is going to be the straw to break the camel's back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's especially like really disheartening because just thinking geographically of this documentary and thinking of Latin America as a whole and how Haiti is excluded from the conversation around mm-hmm. America just because it's the most Black country in Latin America, I think speaks to the larger idea, not idea, but truth that Latin America is so colorist and mm-hmm. and really just delusional, honestly. You can see it. And even I'm going to bring up the point again of like the Dominican Republic being 80% Black and you're trying to kick out Black people and that are Blacker than you in your country, but you are also Black. Like what is that? Like, but you have people who, and I've seen this in my Honduran family members who are visibly Black. They don't see themselves as Black and they separate themselves from people who are darker than them and like, oh, they're morenos, but I'm not. And it's this brainwashing from colonialism. I was talking to Jocelyn while we were watching the movie about Gasta paintings. And I feel like this is where really I feel like when you look at Gasta paintings and you look at this documentary, you can kind of get a historical reference to where a lot of these ideas are coming from, a lot of these concepts that we have internalized as a whole region, just like where they started from the Spaniards trying to classify race based on your skin tone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh my God. I'm so glad you brought up the Casas paintings because, you know, all of with the president was talking about like the, you know, the population of DR being like 80% Black. He was also saying it was like Black and mulattoes. Mm-hmm. And he makes that distinction. And mulatto, of course, is a term that comes from the Casas, mm-hmm. right? Like it's, you know, that classification of like your half Black, you're like one step up, right? Mm-hmm. I remember Delilah, our professor Delilah was talking about, she had her whole series about the Casas paintings. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about like how those paintings really were about, you know, their anxiety around tracking the Black blood, like how much African blood was in people and how much do you need to get back to white or how much or like how much how who the can marry who to... not even proximity, it's like literally how do you bleach a line back to white if you're coming from like, so if you have a mulatto who marries a Spaniard, their child is another, like another title that I can't think of the name, but if that child marries a white person, their child will be considered white again. Right? Like they're like trying to figure and maneuver how all this works. But it's like everybody kept mixing because there's so many paintings and classifications because there's so many people coming and going in colonial Latin America that I think sometimes they don't really talk about. Like there's a large influx of Chinese people mm-hmm. who were here as well. And of course, the indigenous populations, of course, the African populations, and then of course, the Europeans. But you know, but they're all these people are mixing, and then like they're mixing in different ways, and like all of it is sound. The fact that they made so many paintings, like to me, says like there was a lot of social anxiety around race, and just by the sheer number of them and the sheer number of labels and classifications that they had.
Yeah.
And for them, racism fueled Punnett Square. The most convoluted way to.
Basically, yeah.
Stop counting. Stop naming. I don't know. That frustrates me.
Yeah. But that. Because of that, I feel that people are so like these things exist because of that, and people are so like stuck in this idea because they were socialized into that. And you have these groups like these white Karens, who I say they're white because they are, because they hold the social, economic, and political power that we do here in the U.S. And they hold it because they were colonized, and they have a little percentage of white and more than the rest of these other races in their bodies and in their DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So they benefit from whiteness. Therefore, they're white, you know? And I feel like the way that translates to identity here in the U.S., like, especially with Latinos, it's disgusting, man. Like, you have Latinos who are beige, and like, I'm so oppressed, blah, 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 and speak anti-Black shit in the same breath. And it's like, do you know you're white? You don't. It's disappointing.
I once read that I think not in DR, but I would imagine in other places in Latin America as well. But in Puerto Rico, they have, so in the US we have the one drop rule, which is like the law of hypo descent, meaning that, you know, one drop of Black blood makes you white or makes you Black, regardless of what you look like. But in Puerto Rico, they had hyper descent, meaning that one drop, if you had one white ancestor, you could claim whiteness. And I thought that was really, really fascinating. Because it just goes to show like the power of whiteness and how, like, you know, its ability to move you socially and class-wise, wealth-wise, right? If you can claim it, then people do. But yeah,
I mean, this also made me think about the idea of, like you said again, like in that the sort of the cultural shift between those two places versus the U.S.'s version. Just thinking about the experience of race and ethnicity and charting all these things, how you cross a border, you go across an ocean, and your social standing just fluctuates. Like, it's so arbitrary. But it's only in its, like you said, in the sort of socially cemented ways that you can benefit. Like, if you were to go somewhere where there's no concept of whiteness to power or anything like that, and it's just, you just see a rainbow of people, and you come in and go, I am in charge now because of my skin. I feel like you would get like a crowd of people laughing at you if that idea wasn't introduced.
I'm stuck on the fact there's even a place like that exists, because I feel like
it would be like in the ocean. It'd have to be like have you ever heard of the story of the man without a country?
No, I don't think so.
It's old, and it's definitely propaganda, but it's like old US propaganda during the it was like supposed to be in to bolster support for the union. I want to say right during maybe the Civil War, during the Civil War, mm-hmm. and it was this man gets charged for treason. I think his name was like Nolan, and it's a short story. And he, in the middle of the trial, he's like, "I'm pissed off. You're charging me for treason. I don't claim the U.S. anymore." And the judge is like, "Okay," and they just put him on a boat for years until he dies. And he dies being like, "I wish I loved America. I'm kind of sad that I don't get to be an American now." But he's out there. Like they put the money out to have him go from boat to boat. And no one's allowed to share news with him. No one's allowed to, like, talk about the U.S. with him. But he was by himself, more or less. Like, he couldn't really socialize. But if you had a whole island out there...
It's Drexia.
You right. You're absolutely right. We should all get some floaties and go make our little no colorism, no racism, can we outlaw saltine crackers and like other things that don't have flavor,
and boiled chicken.
I had a student refer to herself as boiled chicken once, and I
no
she was like, "I'm white, I'm boiled chicken, I have no culture." I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, oh, sweet child.
But it's frustrating.
She's saying that because she identifies with the concept of whiteness and not with mm-hmm. actual ancestry.
I know. And that was what I was trying to get to her. I was like, your family was something before they were white. Like, she mentioned something about like German, and I was like, well, you need like, girl, Germany has a rich history, aside from that Holocaust stuff, but they have a really rich history, you know, and like folk tales and like all that kind of stuff. Like, there's lots of things for you to explore within your German heritage. You don't have to, like, that's the thing, like, white people globally should divest from whiteness. It's not serving them. They have no culture now. It's not serving them, mm-hmm. right? Like, their children are growing up just being vultures of everything, everybody else's culture, and saying it's the internet culture. And it's like, it's not. Like, you know?
Even when you think, like, I feel like you make a really good point, like, diverging from the idea of whiteness. Because it's like, it's new. Or in a sense, like in its function, because I keep thinking about like the way, like the U.S. and other places too. I mean, definitely other places as well, like in England as well, mm-hmm. being like no Irish, like or no specifying to, you know, sort of the people they would label. Granted, it's, you know, it's, I would say what it's a. The, like a slur now or a taboo word, the
for the Romani people,
yes, like being like, you know, and labeling a lot of people as dogs, and then enough time passing for people to kind of fold under the umbrella of whiteness if they choose to do so, out of assimilation.
But like, also their assimilation was based on how well they could oppress people who are lower than them too.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a stepping ladder of like pain and suffering. You only can stand on other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Mm-mm-mm.
Now my palms are all sweaty. I'm angry.
Like I said, it's like parasitic.
It is. It truly is. And I say white people should divest from whiteness, but I don't think they will, because this is like the first time in history that regular white people can be important. And I say that thinking about like the history of Europe and how some of them probably like descended from serfs and stuff, you know, like people who were working the land like before they came to the U.S. And you know, wealth and power was associated with a particular bloodline, but that's still the, and that's still kind of the case in Europe, but with the invention of whiteness, poor white people can access some privilege now, and in turn get to oppress other people. And so I don't, even as much as I want white people to divest from whiteness, I don't think they will, because they seem to be very content.
It's too
lucrative to them. But regardless, the work continues of combating all of this stuff. And as I think, I don't remember if it was Jocelyn or Jess that said this, but Rosa eventually has to seek asylum in the US towards the end of the film. Because the president, the guy running for president, Danilo Medina, won again. I think he won again. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, basically the nationalists won, the conservatives won, even though it says he's part of the Liberation Party. See, this is the other thing. These terms be getting me.
Yeah.
Like, liberate, what are you liberating? What does that mean? I'm like, okay. But whatever. There's like, and then there's also a modern as well. Like, what does that mean?
It's modern.
Boy.
What is modern revolution?
What, that's what I would like to know. I mean, but that's all these kind of political terms that are thrown around.
It's propaganda.
Yeah. It is very much propaganda, yes.
That in the documentary they were talking about when they were putting up when Rosa Iris was watching TV and all of these political ads. Do you remember that?
Yes.
3 out of 5 ads are paid by the government, and all, like, the majority of them were for Medina.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do remember that. Because it's like there's all these other people who are running and who are doing like the hard work of going from like town to town and talking to people, like physically talking to people, mm-hmm. to get them to go out and vote. And that doesn't, you don't get to see that, right? It's just Medina and friends, whoever he wants in his cabinet, whoever he wants in these different positions throughout the island.
Yeah, it's, and like these political names, and you have, I'm sure they have, like, I haven't been to the Dominican Republic, but my reference point is El Salvador, and with their new government over there called Nuevas Ideas or New Ideas, they're after so much of corruption from these other political parties, their name gives people this false hope. And this president, Bukele, has completely replace the assembly with people from his party so he can have absolute control. That's like a fucking dictatorship, essentially. And his face is plastered on so many shirts selling on the street. People sell face masks with his face on it. And I'm like, does this exist in some level in the Dominican Republic to keep this, to keep Medina in power, keep like this political party in power? Because you have the TV propaganda, you have merch that's like familiarizing these people with this politician's face. And like I was telling Jocelyn while we were watching the documentary that voting over there is similar to voting in El Salvador. And I think that's how they do it in a lot of countries in Latin America, where you go to the ballot box and you have your ballot has the photos of the politicians, and you have to mark an X over the photo of the politician you're voting for. So it's like, if you have these images of this politician being blasted in your face, of course you're going to vote with someone who you're familiar with.
Right. And images are powerful. Mm-hmm. We know that. That's interesting, because, you know, like here in the U.S., you go to vote, and you're like, who are these people? Like,
who is John Jingle Jim Hyman Smith?
I mean, because it will just have their name, and like, there's no, and there's no kind of like propaganda allowed at the polling location. Mm-hmm. So like people trying to get you to really recognize their names. So when you go in the ballot and you read it, like that has a different thing versus like, I recognize that face. Yeah. Like we remember images more than we do letters on a page.
Yeah. And like, I feel like there's a practical aspect to it, like especially with people who are can't read or write. Mm-hmm. These images of these politicians there to make it easy for them to vote, or there's like a practical aspect of it or to it. But when mm-hmm. you add propaganda to it, it's just it does a complete 180. Mm-hmm. It's insidious.
new title of the documentary.
Insidious.
No relation to the horror movie.
We're back onto horror movies.
That's Marcellus. He just like stayed trying to get me to watch some horror movies. It's not gonna happen, sir. Okay. Not gonna happen.
Okay.
I'm trying to see what other films the director has made. So she has a film from 2013 called American Promise. I haven't heard of that before. Changing the Same and Slaying Goliath. That sounds intense.
Oh, wait. That sounds very familiar to me.
Which one?
Slaying Goliath.
She also has another film called The Killing Zone.
Which I want to be a guest on our podcast and we can watch another one of her movies?
Sure. Another yes. Because I really like the way this... What is it?
Sorry. I do know I've talked about this, that last movie you said, Slaying Goliath, to someone before.
Slaying Goliath? What was it about?
It's... you get this sort of intimate documentary about an amateur youth basketball team. Mm. And they're called, like, the Huskies. And they're trying to go... They're new. They're trying to take everything they can to get to the top of it. But it's like there's a dark side to amateur sports, and it's kind of sad, parts of it. But
this one, the Changing the Same sets, is in the Florida Panhandle. It says lies the provincial town of Mariana, Florida, where president and poet L. Lamar Wilson runs a particular marathon in hopes of lifting the veil of racial terror caused by the town's buried history. Interesting. Huh. I'm definitely down for us to do, to come on Chicas Who Read and watch another of Michelle Stevenson's documentaries. So I think she's telling really important stories that need to be highlighted.
And she's a woman director, so it's nice to like highlight
people. Yes. Yes.
Most of her DP team, most of her directors of photography was a mostly female team.
Really?
Yeah, I think there's two men, but no, all pretty diverse.
Love to see it. Oh, the American Promise one is about her son.
Aww.
About her son and his best friend as they go through the U.S. education system.
Wow. Miss Jocelyn is a substitute teacher here.
Okay. Are you really?
Yeah, but I haven't I'm gonna start doing it this fall.
Do you know the substitute teaching, do they assign you like basically any grade level?
Yeah, so I applied. I guess I can't, I don't know if I can say what district, but you apply to the district and there's a website you can go on.
Mm-hmm.
You can take on any job that's available. So yeah, I can literally be from pre-K to senior year.
That's going to be, I feel like that would be fun.
Those are very similar ages. Very similar.
my God. Well, maybe, yeah. They're both prone to outbursts. So, you know. Oh, my gosh.
Definitely some interesting stories, I think, will happen. Hopefully not. Hopefully not too interesting.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I guess we should kind of wrap it up. But what are, I guess, your final thoughts or takeaways from the film?
I think Michelle Stevenson is a really good director. I'm excited to see more of her work. Like you said, she's telling really good stories that need to be told to the public. And I'm glad we got to see this because I was not aware of the whole Dominican and Haitian issue. So I'm glad that I'm educated now on this issue.
Same. Yeah. No, I think this documentary touches on so many things, so many other things when you compare it to the lives that, well, when I compared it to the life that I lead here in the United States. And I think particularly for Latinx folks who live in the U.S., I think this would be a great documentary to look into. And even, I mean, Latinos who aren't in the U.S., because it speaks to so many different things. So, yeah. I loved it. And yes, I'm definitely going to binge watch like Michelle Stevenson's stuff. Because she's amazing. That film is, like I said, that film is beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. And like the story that was kind of like the fictional, I don't think it was fictional, but like the story about the little girl, like that was kind of the transition as throughout. I think ultimately, if I remember, I was trying to like get dressed and watch the end of it. So I think the little girl dies in the end of the story, but her spirit is like a spirit of like the rivers and like protects little children, if I'm not mistaken.
You know what? I know we're trying to wrap it up, but I want to bring this up. The beginning scene of that, of the beginning of that story made me think of the thoughts that you're having right now towards your specific work about water and how, because it's like the beginning scene is this little black child hiding in water and you can see above eyes and there's a lot of water imagery in this part of the documentary. And so it made me think of like the questions that you've been asking, like how do you segregate water?
Yeah, I was really attracted to those scenes as well, and like the story in of itself. And so I'm still making water videos. I have video that I shot in Galveston that I need to do something with. I'm just kind of like sitting on at the moment because I haven't quite found what I want to say or how to piece it together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I am really interested in just water's like social political history and its relationship to Blackness and to also to the supernatural in some ways too. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I loved those scenes as well. I really did. And so I'm excited to watch more Michelle Stevenson's work as well.
We stand. This is a Michelle Stevenson
stand. That's like, I'm sure like Marcellus, I don't know what you're going to name this podcast. Marcellus just comes up with the names like off the fly.
You guys have the best names.
That's all Marcellus.
That's what they call me. Marcellus, pick a name, Cooper.
Pick a name, Cooper.
So, I feel like it does a lot of because I think it does as much as a documentary can, right? Because it's still, no, you try to be as truthful as possible, but mm-hmm. I think it gives enough space to truth while mm-hmm. trying to be fair. But it's hard. I think I like the fact that it prioritizes keeping the human quality of people we see, because it's just dehumanize and make it all about the information.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I appreciate the sort of tender hand that it has, and that we get to see.
Mm-hmm.
We get to see everything for what it is, and judge it on our own accord.
Yeah. I agree. I really enjoyed it as well. Well, the film festival is still happening, and I know that I think more than half of us are trying to see the next film that comes out tonight. So we're gonna wrap it up. We first want to thank Jocelyn and Jessica for talking with us today. You guys have been great. And we look forward to having y'all, or we look forward to being on y'all's podcast whenever you guys have us. We also want to thank our Patreon guests, Lord. See, this is we've talked, Marcellus, our patrons, thank you. Me and Marcellus, like Jess and Jocelyn, me and Marcellus have got our outros have gotten like slightly clumsy. It was just like, oh, who and what else do we say? And thank you. Oh, and who and why and where? Oh, okay. And now then, oh, wait, I got a thing.
That's just the routine now.
Oh, no.
Hard.
Mm-hmm. They are hard. I was telling him we should just pre-record it. And he was like, no. He was like, no. I'm like, okay.
Certain type of finesse to make it just gracefully, like, bloop. Finish, you know,
that is true
for the listeners out there.
this is the spice. This is the flavor.
Okay, let me try it again.
All right, I'm ready for it.
All right, so we want to thank our patrons on our Patreon accounts. We want to thank Caitlin D, Chi Chi O, and Jerome C. Thank you so much for being a patron. This is now a new part of one of the tiers of the Patreon, is that we give shout outs at the end of the episodes or to our patrons for supporting us. You can follow us at Where I See Me, all one word, on Twitter, Instagram, and of course, consider joining our Patreon and supporting the podcast.
I want to give a shout out to our lovely friends Playdate for our outro music. Why don't we talk about it? You can find that nice tune on Spotify and Apple Music, all places you listen to your tunes. They're fellow lovers of media and all good things. So give them a listen. Well, I have been Marcellus.
And I'm Jamie.
Stay nerdy.
And stay black.
Sensational.